This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Give us a sense, in a nutshell, what went wrong? We thought we were headed toward this summit on June 12th. It's all off.
I think the president's team reached the appropriate conclusion that there was not sufficient preparation to have even that first meeting when the North Koreans didn't show up for the scheduled planning meetings. I think this is a prudent step. I think it's likely they will continue. Keep in mind that President Trump has already made substantial concessions to Kim Jong-un to get him to come to this meeting.
The XRT retail ETF in the green for a fifth straight session, this ahead of retail earnings next week with names like Kohl's, Ralph Lauren, Tiffany all set to report. So is now the time to step in?
I'd like to begin by saying that based on the recent statement of North Korea, I have decided to terminate the planned summit in Singapore on June 12th. While many things can happen and a great opportunity lies ahead, potentially, I believe that this is a tremendous setback for North Korea and indeed a setback for the world.
Three big stories driving the market this week is President Trump pulls out of the North Korean summit. We also had a big story on Friday that sent oil prices reeling with Saudi Arabia and Russia saying they're going to step up production, so pull back in oil prices. And one of the big winners this week, we have retail stocks flying this week as retail profits turn out better than expected. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in Hour 1, Richard Dixon from Lowry's is going to be my technician. You're going to want to hear what he has to say. Underneath the surface, this bull market is still there and is looking stronger than ever. It's going to surprise you. He's got three sectors that are the ones you want to be in and put your money in. And the other thing he said is the death of the TINA trade, which is there is no other alternative to stocks. He's got a lot to say with a packed interview coming up in Hour 1. Dan Steffens will also be joining me in Hour 1 as we take a look at the energy markets. That big announcement on Friday, well, it may be pulling oil prices down, but as Richard Dixon said, you're going to want to have some cash ready to buy energy. It's one of the best performing sectors, and it's unlikely, given the Saudi Arabian IPO of Aramco next year, they're going to want to see oil prices go below 80. We're still looking at $80 oil prices, and over this Memorial Day weekend, as the driving season begins, well, if you're a consumer, get ready to pay higher gas prices. They're going over $3 nationally. Unfortunately, if you live in California, we're over $4, $4.50, and could be heading to $5. All of that coming up in Hour 1.
And I'm John Loeffler. You know, today on The Big Picture, we're going to alert you to the one big risk that seems to be floating out there that very few people are discussing, and that is liquidity in the markets, along with its three factors driving that risk: high frequency trading, passive index investing, and government regulation. And for The Big Picture today, we're going to spend a lot of time examining these three factors and, of course, how that impacts your investing and what you should be doing to defend yourself from another potential storm which may be headed your way. All of that today on The Big Picture on the Financial Sense News Hour.
Well, since late January, the stock market has become more volatile. Small news items seem to move the markets on an almost weekly basis. Is this the beginning of something serious, or are we still in a bull market with further highs ahead? Joining us on the program is Richard Dixon from Lowry Research. And Richard, I guess the first thing I want to get to is, what is your buying and selling pressure indicators telling you about this sideways market we seem to be stuck in?
Well, it's telling us that we're, number one, still in a bull market, and number two, that we're seeing some signs that underneath all this volatility, there's a process of gradual accumulation going on. In other words, that people are using dips as buying opportunities. What's most noticeable about those two indicators is that selling pressure, which is our primary measure of the trend in supply, has been reaching new lows for the entire bull market over the past couple of weeks. And at the same time, buying power remains in a long-term uptrend, although it's been a little bit more sluggish. What that seemed to suggest is that you're not really seeing the kind of volume on the up days that you would expect to see, or perhaps you need to see, to break the large cap indexes like the S&P and Dow Jones Industrials out from this volatile trading range. But at the same time, with supply plumbing new depths, it seems to be sort of counterintuitive that we could be in a process of forming any kind of major top, which normally requires an increase in selling.
You know, how unusual is this? Because usually, I know you have developed these indicators, and I've used them for 70, 80 years now. As you get close to a market top, even though the indexes are hitting new highs, you start seeing distribution, which is reflected in your selling pressure. So basically what you're seeing, you're seeing no signs of this at this point.
Well, as a matter of fact, over the last couple of days, out of curiosity, I looked back at our historic data, which takes us back to 1925, and looked at all the major market tops, in other words, the tops in every bull market that we've had from 1929 through 2007. And the one thing that I did find that was consistent was that in no cases, and by that I mean none, was there a major market high formed when selling pressure was at a new low, as it was back on January 26th when the S&P and the Dow Jones hit their highs so far for the bull market. So, you know, on a historic basis, unless this time it's different, the fact that selling pressure was at a new low for the bull market as of the January high would suggest that we're in a correction, but not in any kind of a start of a major decline.
So I know that you use these indicators, buying and selling pressure, to look at the markets, but you also use them to look at the sectors. And one of the big drivers that we've seen in the markets over the last 2 years has been the technology sector. There was a little bit of a worry of some government regulations coming in, possibly with the social media stocks. What are your indicators telling you in terms of selling and buying pressure on a particular industry? Is there anything that stands out? In other words, is technology still looking good?
Technology is still looking good. It's a little bit more fragmented than it had been in the past. But as far as market leadership, energy obviously has been the leader. It really got overextended. And I see that there's some agreement on oil increased production, which has caused the oil prices to go down. Actually, the selling in the sector really started prior to today's announcement, obviously. But the longer-term outlook on it still looks very good. So we would look at the pullback in the energy stocks right now as a buying opportunity. Infotech continues to, as I said, look good, although a little bit more fragmented. Software is clearly the leading group in that sector. And finance is still looking good with the major banks and regional and super-regional banks in particular looking attractive right now. So you know, that seems to be where the leadership is. The problem area is really in the value stocks, consumer staples or consumer non-cyclical stocks, a good number of which are populating the new 52-week lows, even as the market is trading certainly nowhere close to its lows right now.
You know, that's another sign, I guess, you normally see at market tops. Correct me if I'm wrong, but usually is you get close to market tops where there's the risk of a recession. You see things like consumer staples, things like healthcare, things like utilities switch and become market leaders. And as you just mentioned, there's no sign of that at the present moment.
That's correct.
Let me go to another indicator that you guys follow, and that is your operating only companies. And I wonder if you might just take a little bit of time and explain why you separate that from a regular advanced decline line when you're looking at the number of stocks reaching new highs, new lows, or advancing.
Well, about 50% of the issues that trade on the New York Stock Exchange right now are what we determine non-operating companies. In other words, they're not common stocks. They're preferred stocks, they're closed-end bond funds, they're ADRs, they're foreign stocks, they're hybrid securities. And in many cases, they are interest-sensitive, as you might expect with, say, a closed-end bond fund or preferred stock. And they can react more to changes in the bond market than in the stock market. So about 25 years ago, Lowry decided it was a good idea to create a set of indicators based strictly on common stocks that trade on the New York Stock Exchange, since this is supposed to be a stock market. And as a result, they created this set of indicators based strictly on, it's about 1,500, 1,600 issues, all New York Stock Exchange listed issues that comprise these operating company only indicators. And as you mentioned, things like advanced decline lines, new highs, new lows, we have some other proprietary indicators that we use. And it can be very illuminating in terms of showing divergences when the traditional things like, say, new highs or new lows, the advanced decline lines, are reacting more towards what's happening with interest rates in the bond market than actually what's happening in the stock market among common stocks. In that sense, it's interesting that even though we've had this hesitation, shall we say, in the major indexes like the S&P and the Dow Jones getting back to their January highs, both the New York All Issues and our OCO advanced decline lines, as of May 21st, just a few days ago, were at new bull market highs and also new all-time highs, suggesting that there's quite a bit more strength in the market than being suggested by what you're seeing in things like the S&P.
So when you're looking for, let's say, a market top, you use a number of indicators that sort of confirm one another. You mentioned selling pressure tends to increase even though the indexes are hitting new highs. An increase in selling pressure indicating a lot of investors below the surface are basically getting rid of their stocks. That's one. The other one you use is your operating company advanced decline line, where, you know, fewer and fewer companies are leading the charge. Is there anything else that you use to kind of confirm? In other words, if you were looking at a change in market top, because a lot of, we've had some technicians come on this program saying, hey, we've begun a bear market. And I think you would disagree with that at this point with your indicators telling you what they are. Is there a number of things that you look, is it not just those two, selling pressure and advanced decline line? Are there other things you look at to confirm that the trend is changing?
There are various other things that we use. For one thing, we'll look at segmented advanced decline lines. But we break down the market into the large, mid, and small cap components with the idea that as the bull market ages and people start to move towards lower risk, you know, the, sort of the risk on, risk off trade, you go, you're biased more towards the risk off, that you see the deterioration in breadth begin in the small cap stocks. You see more small cap stocks, for instance, some of the other indicators we use are stocks that are 20% or more down from the 52-week highs. And we'll look for that sort of progressive deterioration that eventually results in this divergence with the advanced decline lines, things like the New York or the OCO broad-based advanced decline lines from highs in the market indexes, which are a fairly widely used indication of an approaching bear market. So what's interesting there, again, is that even in these segmented advanced decline lines, large, mid, and small cap, and we keep two sets, one for the S&P, for the large, mid, small cap S&P indexes, and also for our OCO, we've divided it into those three segments. Each one of those has been making new highs as of May 21st. So there is still, there's no indication of the kind of deterioration that you would see. Reflecting back on one of the other indicators I mentioned, the percent down 20% or more, or the percent of stocks down 20% or more, for that we use our OCO universe. As of the February 8th low to just a couple days ago, the S&P was up about almost 6% from the February 8th low. The number of small caps down 20% or more had dropped by about half. The number of large caps down 20% or more had doubled. This is during a 6% rally in the market. And you know, the main point that we are making right now is that what you're seeing with the S&P and the Dow Jones is extremely deceptive, that you're saying, oh, well, the market's trading, trapped in this trading range. The S&P Small Cap Index, Russell 2000 Index, again, on May 21st, new all-time highs. The advanced decline lines, new all-time highs. Selling pressure, new all-time low, or a new low for the bull market. None of these things are consistent with a market that is even approaching a major top. These are all consistent with a healthy bull market. So when people ask me, you know, are you seeing any signs of a bear market approaching? And I say, no, literally nothing in the indicators that we keep that would suggest that this market either has entered a bear market or is really even close to entering a bear market. The bull market seems to be alive and well, according to our indicators.
Well, you're bringing up some very important points here, and that's the breakout in the small caps and, you know, things like the Russell 2000. Because, as you know, Richard, in the financial press, we tend to focus on the major indexes, the Dow, the S&P, and that's where all the attention is. If the Dow drops 400 or 500 points or 200 points, 300 points, whatever it is, you know, that garners the media's attention. Although I'd like to point out a 200 or 300 point Dow drop on a Dow that's well over 24,000 is really a small potato in terms of market movements today.
Well, when you really just look at the price action of the Dow and the S&P, it can be extremely misleading. I mean, the Dow is 30 stocks, the S&P is 500 stocks. And the interesting thing is that when you look to see, you know, where's the weakness seems to be very, very select in terms of the stocks that are driving the price performance of both of those, the Dow and the S&P. So even in the large cap area, as I said, our large cap advanced decline lines were just recently at 2 all-time highs. So it's a fairly select area that seems to be really the reason for the sluggish performance in the Dow and the S&P. As part of that, just out of curiosity, I looked at the XLP, which is the ETF for the consumer staples and consumer non-cyclical sector. And what was interesting is if you look at the top 10 holdings, they're all obviously large cap. And of those, 9 are in downtrends, and 6 of those 9s, this is as of last week, were at new 52-week lows. So, you know, it becomes fairly obvious when you sort of dig beneath the surface that the weakness that you're seeing in the S&P and the Dow Jones doesn't represent broad-based weakness in the market overall. This is, in fact, the result of relatively narrow weakness in large-cap stocks and a select number of large-cap stocks that are having an influence on the price performance of those two market indexes. And if you go beyond that and you look to see, well, what's going on in the rest of the market, it's almost a unanimous indication of market health.
I want to turn your attention to another market. And I know you guys, in addition to tracking and following the major indexes in small cap stocks here in the U.S., I want to turn your attention to overseas when you take a look at emerging markets. What is your indicators telling you there? Because I'm looking at a downtrend in a lot of these overseas or, let's say, emerging market ETFs. Are you seeing similar or are you seeing problems?
Well, to be honest, we have discontinued our service of the overseas markets. So I'm a little bit of a disadvantage there because I have not looked at any of these in really weeks. So I'm afraid I can't be much help there other than what I hear anecdotally. But as far as being able to give you an in-depth picture of that, my apologies, but we're no longer following those markets.
Well, anybody look at a chart, it's in a clear downtrend, unlike what we're seeing in some of the small indexes that you talk about. So when you see, as you're seeing right now, selling pressures at an all-time low, your advanced decline line is moving higher, and outside a handful of certain stocks, especially the large cap area, that carry weight in the indexes that may give the wrong impression. And you're saying that you're seeing accumulation in terms of these pullbacks that we occasionally get here in the market. What looks the best to you? In other words, if we are experiencing a pullback and there was new money that could be deployed, what would be your favorite sectors here?
The three sectors that I mentioned before, finance, energy, and infotech, to a little lesser extent, healthcare. Those would be my top four where I'd be looking for buying opportunities. Particularly the energy sector, which, if you look at a long-term chart on that, looks absolutely very, very good. As I said earlier, it's become the most extended of the 10 sectors that we follow. And as a result, seeing this profit-taking selling right here is, I guess, really no big surprise. But given the overall underlying strength that we're seeing in terms of market breadth, in terms of supply and demand measures, which suggest that the pullback here represents a buying opportunity.
And I guess maybe a reverse question would be if those three sectors, tech, finance, and energy, look the best in terms of strength, what sectors, if any, would you avoid?
Consumer non-cyclicals and telecom would be the two ones. I'm watching utilities very closely. Utilities obviously has done relatively well here over the last 6 weeks or so. That's a little counterintuitive when you see interest rates rising, although rates have pulled back here lately. You would think that utilities would be an area that would be especially vulnerable to higher interest rates. As we were talking about a regulated industry here, so there could be getting many big earnings surprises out of them. Part has been driven by gas utilities, which are probably associated with the rise in energy stocks. But that's, you know, particularly electric utilities, I'd be very cautious with those, particularly on run-ups in price. You know, unless you're very long-term, you just want to own it for the dividends. The dividends are stable. You don't care what the price of the stock does, which probably the case for in many cases. But the interesting thing is, though, that the so-called TINA trade that was driving the market for years off the 2007 low, people looking for yield, and there's no alternative but equities since bond yields were, you know, down so low, that trade really, I think, is over. One of the things I follow is the difference between the three-month T-bill yield, which I use as the risk-free rate of return, and the S&P dividend yield. And a year and a half ago, the spread was about 200, a little bit more than 200 basis points, or over 2 percentage points, in favor of the S&P dividend yield over this three-month T-bill yield. As of this last week, it was 1 basis point. They were basically even. So, you know, the advantage that you have in buying stocks for their yield versus a fixed income return really is gone. And the thing that right now that would seem to be driving the market, which is really earnings. We've gone back to more traditional stock market, not driven by, well, what's your yield, to what's your earnings. And I think that may be one reason why you're seeing this choppiness in the market since January in the terms of the S&P. Since large cap stocks can be most affected by things like international trade, the strength in the dollar, what's Trump going to do with tariffs? All these questions are causing volatility. And as you just saw in the last couple of days, I'm not sure why collapsing of the talks with North Korea would have a major impact, but it would seem that this is the kind of thing that's driving the market right now. It has much of a less of an impact on things like small cap stocks, which are going to be more domestically oriented. You could see new highs. So it's a different environment today than what we had, and that's one reason why we're emphasizing these cyclical stocks and things like banks, which would hope to benefit from higher interest rates.
So summing up, Richard, as you look at the market, one of the key things that would tell you there was trouble ahead would be an increase in selling pressure. And right now, selling pressure is at an all-time low. You've never seen a market top when selling pressure is low. The other thing you have going for you is your advanced decline line continues to hit new highs. And then maybe a third is the small cap stocks are hitting record highs as well. So outside a handful of stocks that maybe dominate the major indexes, maybe giving a false illusion that, you know, the markets are in trouble. From your perspective, things look pretty good.
That's absolutely correct. You've put it in a nutshell.
Well, Richard, as we close, I know you guys have been doing this for longer than anybody I know in the business and have had a successful track record of calling tops and bottoms. If our listeners would like to follow or get more information about the work that you guys publish, which I consider excellent, how could they do so, please?
Well, the easiest thing to do is just Google Lowry Research. It's L-O-W-R-Y. And there's no E in it like the spice people. But L-O-W-R-Y Research, and that will take you to the webpage where they can have a free trial on our various levels of our websites and get a feel for the kind of research that we're doing.
Well, listen, thanks so much for a very informative interview. It's interesting that when you see things on the surface, when you look below it, it tells a different story. Richard, thanks so much for joining us.
Certainly welcome, Jim. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
5G is not just about a faster smartphone. It's really about building out the IoT. It's about the machine economy. So when we think about our previous conversation of AI and quantum computing, the way I look at 5G is that it's the connective tissue between the artificial intelligence and quantum computing in the cloud and the digital nervous system for the machines, the IoT, Internet of Things, in the field. And the objective is to build very dense networks, perhaps 100,000 sensors per city block.
I'm Chris Sheridan, host of FS Insider. And Jim, I want to ask you about the interview that you did with Danielle DiMartino Booth this week on Wednesday. There's something that she said that I think we should really elaborate on and dig into with our audience today. And that was when she was talking about this idea, I think it comes from Goldman Sachs, about liquidity being the new leverage. This shouldn't be something that's too foreign to our audience because, as many of you will know, this is a subject we've been discussing for quite some time on Financial Sense News Hour. You've been discussing, you know, the problems of liquidity or illiquidity, phantom liquidity, how it's even been referred to in the past as well, through your big pictures. So, John, let's play that one clip of Danielle where she talks about the problem of liquidity in the markets today.
If almost half the market is index funds and they need to sell, who are they going to sell to?
Well, that's a really good question. I think it's an open-ended question. The only thing that we can say with certainty about indexing is, without a shadow of a doubt, we completely understand what the size of the entrance is, and that's infinity. But nobody can tell you what the size of the exit is, because nobody knows what the situation is going to be when there's an overabundance of sellers and the momentum trade turns. It's interesting that people think that there was some kind of Armageddon situation that played out in February. That was really nothing. It was the tip of the iceberg. We didn't even really see credit volatility move. Credit volatility is what will eventually move the stock market, not stock market volatility. That's the tail wagging the dog when you consider how much larger in scope the credit market is compared to the stock market. But truly, I cannot answer that question. Anybody who pretends to answer that question shouldn't be trying to answer that question, because we simply do not know. The floodgates have opened, allowing all of this money to pour into index funds, and we could see a liquidity seize up in this next downturn that we couldn't even begin to identify with 2008. Goldman Sachs wrote, you know, in my opinion, a seminal, very short report earlier this year that said liquidity is the new leverage. And think about that for a few minutes, just a few words. Liquidity is the new leverage. And I think that means we will find out what the ramifications are of having piled into indexing simply based on the low fee structure, having zero comprehension of what capital losses will be sustained one day.
So there was Danielle talking about how liquidity is the new leverage. And Jim, since liquidity may be a nebulous concept or something that's a little bit confusing for some people, it's sort of a financial jargon. If you would mind, explain what liquidity is exactly and why she is raising this as a topic of concern.
Well, when we think of liquidity, think of what you as an investor do every single day. If you own a stock, you own a mutual fund or an ETF, liquidity means that when you go to sell it, you can sell it. You can get your money. You're not going to have any difficulty. Or if you want to go into the market and buy something, there's enough liquidity in trading, meaning the shares are available to buy, the shares are available to sell. Now, the problem that you have, and we've seen this in flash crashes, and let me give you an example. Let's say a stock is trading at $10 a share. And underneath that market of $10 a share, you might have some bids in the market at $9.50, $9.75, at $9, maybe even some as low as $8.50. And then after $8.50, there's no bids whatsoever. Here's what happens. When there is a market panic, Chris, and all of a sudden everybody goes to sell, you blow right through those bids below $10 all the way to the $8. And after that, it's like a free falling elevator. There are no bids out there. So you're trying to sell. The only trouble is there's nobody on the other end that's doing the buying. So you can't get out. And if people think that this can happen again, remember what happened
in the financial crisis where the Fed had to actually come in and backstop money market funds because they were losing money and you couldn't get your money out. Or if you want to take a look at the commercial paper market where actually it seized up and stopped functioning. And so when we say liquidity, it means the ability to buy and sell anytime you want with no restrictions and the ability to do so.
I also like how she talked about how the dollar plays into this with the amount of dollar denominated debts in the emerging markets. That was definitely a focus of the interview as well. And there's a number of things that are coming together that I know that she has on her radar, many topics that we have been discussing on the program. But another area that she looked at is bond funds and how some of these forces come together when we think about liquidity risks with bond funds and the concentration that we see in the market currently. Let's go ahead and play that clip to hear what she had to say.
Clearly, the situation you have in the stock market is going to be magnitudes worse when it comes to the credit market, simply because liquidity mismatch is going to be that much more acute. So again, Janet Yellen, it was a very rare moment for her years ago. She expressed alarm about two different things, biotechnology stocks, which have pretty much corrected at this point, and high-yield ETFs. Now, this is a woman who, for the most part, market data made her eyeballs roll into the back of her head. So the fact that somebody at the New York Fed markets desk had brought to her attention how very dangerous high-yield ETFs were was saying something, that she was actually publicly expressing anxiety in what could potentially happen in the event of a market disruption. Again, we don't know. We simply have no idea. And making matters that much worse is Dodd-Frank, which disincentivized banks years ago from holding bonds on their balance sheet. We know that bond inventories have completely collapsed. They've gone from over $250 billion to about $30 billion on big broker-dealer balance sheets. That means that the backstops that have been in place in prior downturns are not there anymore. So there's even less of a cushion, despite the fact that we're talking about the ETF structure. So, you know, again, I worry about mom and pop investors who have bought into bond ETFs, thinking that this is the most cost effective way to invest in the safest securities in my portfolio. If you think about how disorienting it will be to them, that they will suffer the greatest capital losses in some of these bond funds.
And I know when she was talking about the bond ETFs, you know, that a lot of investors have gone out to try to get higher yields and have used ETFs as one of the primary vehicles for that. There's that problem there where you have a liquidity mismatch. And I know that this is something that we've been discussing for, gosh, at least a year, probably more. And I know that you began warning about bond funds as well for this exact reason. So it's nice to know that, you know, we've been ahead of this and have recognized a lot of these problems that are emerging here when we think about just the lack of available bonds that are put into these ETFs. And if a bunch of people sell, right, that's going to create a problem because they can see pretty steep losses in a short amount of time. Is that essentially the same concern that she was expressing?
Oh, absolutely. And we're covering it this week on the program in rather extensive detail because it's not just her. It's also the SEC. The SEC, a number of years ago, went to the mutual fund industry and they said, look, you guys are buying a lot of stuff that doesn't trade and is not very liquid. So the SEC asked mutual fund companies to put the liquidity of the bonds they held into four buckets, one being the least liquid. In other words, if you went to sell, you couldn't get your money for 7 days. And that's if you had like 15% or more of your portfolio. Well, the Wall Street Journal did a story where some of the biggest bond funds from Vanguard to others had 30 and 40% of their portfolio in illiquid bonds. So on the surface, you're trading the ETF, Chris, like you and I would. Let's say I want to sell you my shares of a bond fund. Right now, we can do that. But in a market panic, when you seize up, what happens when the underlying securities that are in those mutual funds cannot be liquidated? And I know when this happened, when there were credit spreads that blew out at the beginning of 2016, I know as a firm, we were able to go in and buy a 1-year bond with a 5% coupon and a 5% discount, and we got a 10% rate of return because the mutual funds were forced to sell at values well below. If you think about it, a one-year bond paying 5% was selling at a discount. And the only reason we were able to get that is these bond funds were forced to sell at prices they really didn't like, but they had no choice.
Yeah, the really neat thing about Danielle, too, is that, you know, she's not just some analyst that's trying to raise a red flag here that no one's ever heard of. You know, she has quite a bit of experience, right? She worked for 9 years at the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. She was an advisor to the president of the Dallas Fed, Richard Fisher. She wrote a book that I know that you read, Fed Up, An Insider's Take on Why the Federal Reserve is Bad for America. And she's also a regular contributor at Bloomberg View. So she has a lot of experience in this area, and she's also coming from it having been inside the Fed itself, seeing how it runs, some of the problems that developed with quantitative easing and the way that these things are going to be impacting the markets in the future. So it was such a fascinating interview that you did with her, and I definitely want to encourage any of our listeners to check out that interview if they haven't already.
I really do highly recommend listening to this interview because a couple of weeks ago, we did a show, The Epicenter of the Next Crisis, talking about the emerging market. In this interview, she brings up another epicenter that could be a major crisis. I'm not going to take it away from the story, and you'll want to hear about it because it was one that I found rather surprising and one that is worth keeping a watch on in terms of not just the emerging market, but another crisis that is brewing out there. And you can find that on FS Insider. So, Chris, if our listeners would like to find out more about FS Insider, tell them how they could do so, please.
Yeah, certainly. So they can go to financialsense.com, and if they go to the Financial Sense NewsHour page, they'll see that every Wednesday through Friday is when we run FS Insider, three different podcasts a week. And last week's shows, we talked to Woody Prusel from 13D Global Strategy and Research, and we talked about the rollout of 5G, fifth generation technology, and why this is so important. He really described it as the connective tissue between a lot of different technological arms races that are taking place with China, the US, Russia, and how this is going to impact many different industries. So that was a really fascinating interview that we did on Friday. Also, we talked to Dr. Woody Brock at Strategic Economic Decisions, and he discussed how trade wars essentially have much less of an impact today than they did in the 1930s when we think about Smoot-Hawley. So we talked a lot about the comparison there, also the impossibility of reducing our trade deficit down to zero with China. And that was a wide-reaching interview. He's an extremely bright person and very good communicator of both economics, trade policy. And so there were some real key insights there. And then obviously we talked with Danielle DiMartino Booth on Wednesday with the two clips that we just aired. So lots of great content that we had last week, and every week look forward to the show. Again, you can go find all of our FS Insider content by going to the Financial Sense NewsHour page. And if any of you want to listen to that content on your cell phone, on your iPhone, or on a mobile device, we have a way of doing that as well. If you want to listen to content while you're driving, certainly sign up. You can subscribe, and we can also get that set up for you as well.
Since January, the markets have become more volatile. Uncertainty has returned once again to the financial markets as the Fed continues to raise interest rates, and market liquidity has become an issue. We know eventually the Fed rate hikes could lead to another recession and bear market, which would put your portfolio at risk. Do you have an exit plan or a plan to protect your principal during the next market downturn? Well, many of you don't, and that is where Financial Sense Advisors can help. Give us a call and let us help you develop a strategy that helps you navigate both bull and bear markets and give you the peace of mind that you are prepared for any market outcome.
Give us a call at Financial Sense Advisors. Call toll-free 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor.
Well, the price of oil is falling this week after broaching the $70 mark on news that Russia and Saudi Arabia may increase their production by 1 million barrels to take the tightness out of the market. Joining us from Energy Prospectus Group is Dan Steffens. Dan, let's talk about that. The big news item on this Friday is a news piece coming out that OPEC's largest producers, Saudi Arabia and Russia, would increase their production by 1 million barrels to make up for the shortfalls that we're seeing in places like Venezuela and elsewhere. Let's talk about that and the impact of the market. We have on this Friday, we have oil stocks selling off. The XLE is down sharply. We have West Texas Intermediate crude right around $68 a barrel. And then we have Brent, which was up to almost 80 at 76. So is this something investors should take seriously, or is this a lot more wishful thinking than reality?
Well, I think it's quite a bit more wishful thinking. I think OPEC is not relevant unless people perceive that they have control over the oil market. And they are the countries that do have export capacity. I mean, we're still a major importer of oil. So you got the OPEC countries, and Russia are the only countries really that have much export capacity. So they have to create that illusion. Now, it's my belief that they would have acted a long time ago to increase the quotas of some of the other cartel members to make up for this lost oil out of Venezuela, which is a serious situation and probably going to get a lot worse before it gets better anyway. So they kind of needed to start raising production anyway to make up for that. We're entering into the period of the year when the demand for refined products just spikes like crazy in the summer. I mean, June, July, and August are the highest demand periods for oil.
So when you look at this, you have oil production falling sharply in Venezuela. But one of the big stories, Dan, that I don't think the market focuses enough on, and I think it is the big story. If you look at China, which is now the largest importer of oil in the world, their imports increased by over 7% in the first quarter. Now, that's a big, significant number. So a lot of times, I know the IEA has had to revise upward their demand estimates every single year. But let's talk about the impact of a single country like China. When their imports increased by 7%, I mean, that's a lot of oil.
Yeah, that's a lot. I mean, the demand for oil goes up by like 1.5 million barrels a day per year, just as steady as could be. And unless there's a decline in the global economy overall, that'll just keep happening. I mean, if you did a 50-year chart of oil demand, it's pretty much straight up. And the only time there was a decline in demand was after the big economic crisis in 2008, because that was actually a demand reduction that caused that big price drop in oil. But other than that, you have steady demand constantly. And again, the illusion that U.S. shale oil can fill this gap and we could somehow become a net exporter, that still looks a long way off to me and virtually impossible of ever happening. But we're going to be dependent on OPEC for a long time.
All right, let's talk about another big producer, and this is the U.S., and let's talk about shale production, because everything I read, they're running into bottlenecks, and something that the Journal put out, and I wonder if you'd comment, they took the 20 largest frackers, Dan, and they said basically 15 of them had negative cash flow because they got into a problem. A lot of these companies hedged oil when it was back down around $50 a barrel. And the Journal talked about their expenses exceeded their cash flow by almost $2 billion. So let's talk about shale production and some of the problems in Texas that they're running into now with the lack of infrastructure. They need more pipelines. They need more workers. How does all of this impact the price of oil and the possible production of shale coming out of Texas, let's say the Permian? Because everybody says as the price goes higher, you know, they were talking about 11 million barrels of production this year.
Yeah, and it may get to that. One thing to remember when they talk about those bottlenecks and the bigger companies, when you talk about Pioneer and Concho, EOG, they have already got their takeaway capacity contracted with the midstream companies. So they're not really up against that problem. You have a few that are, they've grown so fast, like Diamondback has grown so fast that they're above what they contracted their takeaway capacity. So it could affect them a little bit. But, you know, they'll truck it out. Now, I'm hearing that the trucking companies that usually charge like $2 or $3 a barrel to, you know, go to your leases, collect oil, and they take it to a hub to put it into a pipeline someplace. But they're not talking about charging $8 to $10 a barrel for those hauling fees. So that's going to really cut into their netbacks. But that's only on the marginal production. Now, yes, it will probably curtail production a little bit or slow down production growth, especially out in the Delaware Basin, which is the way far western half of the Permian Basin. And I've heard there's worker problems. You know, they don't have enough employees out there. It's in the middle of nowhere, for one thing. And then you don't quite have the pipelines built out yet. But they're working on it. And, you know, that's something that's just really temporary. It may take a year from now before they get pipeline capacity and everything up. It just remember, it's always easier to bring production back to where it was than to build it, because you do have to have infrastructure. You do have to have, you know, pipeline capacity and, you know, all the gathering and processing and everything that you have to have. And, you know, these wells produce gas too, and they don't want to just flare all that gas. So you got your gas pipelines out there as well.
You know, I'm always amazed anytime you see news announcements like this, and especially this one that we're talking about today about Saudi Arabia and Russia increasing production by a million barrels. You and I were talking before we went on the air, given the fact that production actually decreased a lot more than what they anticipated because of countries like Venezuela, which production has just fallen off a cliff. If they could have made up the production within OPEC and stay within their production cuts of 1.8 million barrels, why didn't they do it?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I personally believe they really don't have that excess capacity. You notice even in their announcement today, they said if they increase it a million barrels a day, it'll be a gradual increase. Well, that's because they don't have the ability to just run out and open a bunch of valves and produce a million barrels a day. A million barrels a day is a lot of oil, and it creates a lot of logistical problems to ramp up production like that. But they also, their productions in Saudi Arabia comes primarily from big water floods, and that production has to be managed just very carefully. So they just are not going to go start pulling hard on the producers. They can do it for a very short period of time, but you know they don't want to damage those fields. So I just take this announcement as I think something to try to talk down the price of oil a little bit. You know, it's kind of been kind of on a rampage here in the last couple of weeks. We really have only pulled back. We're still in a price range that I've been talking about on my podcast where the support level is at 67 and the resistance is like at 75. So we were like right in the middle of that. Now we're in that lower half of that band. But I wouldn't really worry about this until if you saw a steady drop and it went below 67, then that would concern me that we're pulling back. But and then also you get the traders kind of overreact the day before a big holiday. So we got Memorial Day weekend coming up, and these guys don't want to be long over the weekend when they hear an announcement like this. So I think a lot of this press release today was just to try to curb the sharp increase in price that was concerning people. They want to give the illusion they're working with, you know, Trump, and they want to, you know, do what he says. So anyway, we'll see. But I think the oil price today is kind of an overreaction to what happened.
The other thing, too, as you mentioned, we're entering into one of the strongest periods of the year with demand for oil. And if you look at even today, where the price of oil is at, what, $68, $67 for West Texas Intermediate crude, you look at some of these big companies, whether it's Exxon and some of the others, the profits that a lot of these companies are making, even at $67 oil, $65 oil, one of the big increases in profits that you saw in the first quarter came from the energy sector.
Oh, yeah, right. And, you know, first quarter results were really good, and they're going to be fantastic in the second quarter. You brought up a point a few minutes ago about a lot of these companies still have got quite a bit of their oil hedged, and they've got it hedged in the 50s. So this pullback doesn't impact them that much. I mean, what they're really wanting is their hedges to expire so that they can, you know, start collecting this higher price. The only big company that I follow that's totally unhedged is Continental Resources. So all the other ones got quite a bit of their production hedged, and they do it just so they can, you know, balance out cash flows. You know, the statements that people make about all these companies are out spending cash flow, well, that's if you include all their CapEx programs, and they're growth companies, so they're trying to grow production, grow proven reserves, so some of them aren't outspending cash flow, but I see a lot of them that aren't. I mean, there's a lot of them that are generating a lot of free cash flow now, and they did in the first quarter, even when they had, you know, much lower average price. The average price was still probably in the high 50s in the first quarter.
You know, Dan, when you look at some of these companies, too, and you see this probably more so with the integrateds that have a lot of refining capacity, let's talk about crack spreads and what this means for the refiners. I know Warren Buffett has taken a position in Phillips 66, and, you know, there's one stock that's done real well. But let's talk about the integrateds, because it's not just the upstream operations of exploration, but they're also in the downstream and doing quite well with it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, when you got unemployment goes way down like it is now, you got more people going to work, more people on the road. They got to get back and forth to work. So that increases demand for gasoline, diesel, and I would think the refiners would be making decent money. Now, when the price pulls back a little bit, then their crack spreads are helped a little bit. But the gasoline prices do go up in the summer anyway, just because summer blend gasolines are more expensive to produce. So that's something to consider. I mean, I think you sent me some pictures of gas stations with $4.50 gas. We're not quite there in Texas yet.
Oh, my goodness. You know, they're even talking $5 gasoline in California. Of course, we just hiked taxes here tremendously on gasoline, and there's a political movement to try to repeal that. I don't know if it's going to go anywhere, but, you know, they're talking $3 a gallon nationally, and we're talking $5 here in California.
Oh, yeah. I drove back and forth to Dallas this week, and I paid like $2.79, $2.89, something like that. So we're not even to $3 yet. I mean, if you go to the big discount places, it's still $2.50, $2.60 around there. So we're not quite that bad. But, yeah, it's all taxes in those high-cost states. So
I want to talk about two other elements in the energy area. We talked about one, which I think is important, and that is demand, because they keep forgetting about that. We mentioned China. I want to talk about two other elements. When the price of oil dropped down to $26 a barrel from over 100, a lot of the big investment projects, and I'm talking about the big ones that were coming from the Exxons, the Totals, the Eni's, and some of the big companies, they were throttled back. And if you look at the energy industry itself, on Wall Street, they're rewarding companies that are shareholder friendly, meaning that they're either buying back stock, raising dividends. They're penalizing companies like, let's say, an Exxon, which announced that they're going to invest $50 billion here in the U.S. So a lot of these companies are not making the needed investment in the energy sector, which is needed long term. And that applies also for national oil companies. So that is one factor that is going to catch up with us in the next couple of years. The next factor, Dan, I don't hear anybody talking about this, and that is depletion. I mean, you've got to find and replace 3 to 4 million barrels a day of lost production from aging oil fields. Let's talk about those two factors and what that means for oil over the next couple of years.
Well, there's just going to be steady increase in demand unless there's a big drop in the global economy. I mean, I don't see anybody saying that. You can look at an IEA, that's International Energy Agency. They put out a monthly report, and they are historically low on their demand forecast as they get closer to the end of the year. In fact, even when you're in the early part of the next year, they keep raising their demand forecast for the prior year, which is kind of interesting. But I think we're probably looking at a million and a half to even maybe 2 million barrels a day increase in demand this year. And so you got that going up, and then you got the declines. And more we become dependent, the U.S. becomes dependent on these tight oil plays. And it's not just shale, it's all the tight rocks. But those wells that they drill, those long horizontals, and they frack the heck out of them, and they, you know, bring those things on strong, they have incredible decline rates in the first year of 40, 50% the first year, and then another 20 or 30% the next year. So we now have over half of our production comes from horizontal tight oil plays. And so our national decline rate is at least 20%. So let's say we're 10.5, or let's say we're 11 million barrels a day by the end of the year. So you're talking like 2.5 million barrels a day of new production you have to bring on every year just to hold it flat. So it just gets to be a huge treadmill for the upstream companies to keep doing that. But then now from an economic standpoint, these wells pay out incredibly fast. So that's good. They're getting their money back. In fact, we had a luncheon yesterday in Dallas, and the company was saying these wells that they're drilling are paying out in like less than 8 months. And so they're recycle time. And then they hold out, they pay out, and then they, you know, they're declined, but they're producing like half of what they came on at. And now it's all pure profit. So, you know, they're making money at $65, $70 oil, and they were making money at $50 oil in the first quarter. So.
Well, that's amazing, because if you look at the sell-off in the oil stocks, they act like we're going back to a glut again, which is, I just don't see that happening, but you never know.
There's no glut, believe me. There's no glut. The glut is over. One thing in the U.S., we never really recovered yet from Hurricane Harvey. You know, we lost about 30% of our refining capacity for 3 or 4 months, and we really drained down our refined product inventories, and they're all below 30 days of supply, which is where we should be. And so there's a lot of work that has to be done just to rebuild those supplies. And at the same time, you're entering the high demand period for transportation fuels. So the demand for oil goes up significantly in the summer just because the refiners are the people that use the oil, crude oil, not you and me. So we use the refined products. So their customers, you know, need these refined products. So they're going to be ramping up to 95% production capacity in their refineries. And that's going to really increase demand. And I think, you know, people look at these, the market overreacts these week-to-week changes that EIA puts out every Wednesday. And those are just guesses. That's all they are, based on formulas. And from week to week, the increase or decrease is because of more or less imports, not because production went up that much. So basically, all you're doing is taking it from a floating storage situation, a ship, and putting it onshore. So that's not really an increase in supply. That's just an increase of which tanks it's in. But our U.S. inventory is right in the middle of the five-year average. We use more of this stuff than we did 5 years ago. So we probably should be in the upper half or upper third of the five-year average all the time. We're right in the middle of it. So there's no glut of oil. And OECD inventories in March fell below the five-year average. And my guess is by the end of June, total OECD inventories will probably be 100 million barrels below the five-year average. And as I said yesterday, I gave a presentation yesterday, and I said, you need to remember that this is an industry with very big numbers. You know, they'll hear that, oh, OECD inventories are 2.8 billion barrels. Well, that's about 28 days of supply. I mean, we're in a world that consumes 100 million barrels a day. So it's not like you got 2 years supply in inventory or anything. At most, you have a few months of oil and above ground inventory. So
I want to talk about a new element, not only that we're seeing in the stock market with indexing in high frequency trading, but this high frequency trading has permeated asset classes all across the board. It's not just stocks and bonds. It's also impacting the commodity market. And in the last couple of years, OPEC has been meeting with a lot of these traders and a lot of these algo trading firms because they wanted to understand the oil markets, because this was a new element that they hadn't had to deal with in the past. Let's talk about the impact of these algo traders and high frequency trading on the oil market, which is what I think you're seeing happen in the market today, whether you're looking at oil stocks or you're looking at the price of crude itself.
Yeah, well, you know, if you're not a refinery and you buy oil futures, you know, you have to take delivery of those. If it gets to the end of the contract, you'd have to take delivery of that oil, and then you would have to start paying storage fees on it. So those guys never intend to hold these things to maturity. So they are almost like day traders sometime. And, you know, crude oil is the most active traded commodity in the world by a large margin over anything that's even close. And I think before a holiday like we have now, I think you had these guys set their stop loss orders like really close. And so that's how you could see some of these waterfall days like we have today. But when they come back to start trading again next Tuesday, it could bounce right back. So we'll see. But yeah, I do think this automated trading, high frequency trading has got a lot to do with some of the moves that oil makes. You know, I'm old enough to remember when, boy, a 10 cent change in the price of oil was really a big deal. Now we get dollar changes almost every other day, it seems like.
So as you look at this oil market, if you were to look at where would be a good place to put money to work right now, we're going through a sell-off, so a lot of these stocks are going to become cheaper. Do you like the integrateds? Do you like upstream, downstream companies? What's your favorite sector?
My focus is primarily on upstream companies, but like we discussed a few minutes ago, there's a huge demand for midstream services. Some of these really high-quality midstream companies, they pay really good dividends. Look at PAA is a real good one. Magellan, MMP, they're really good. One Oak I like, which is not an MLP. It's a C-Corp, but has a real high dividend. Those guys that have pipelines into the Permian Basin, when their pipelines are full, they are making a lot of money because they get paid for moving volumes and moving it, treating it, storing it, doing some little amount of refining. Sometimes those midstream services are really in high demand, so that's a good place to look. But, you know, I'm looking at a lot of these upstream companies, and I'm looking at one right now. I mean, the price that they got for oil in the first quarter was $55. That was their average price that they actually received in the first quarter. So they're looking at a $10 increase in price from first quarter to the second quarter, and that's going to be a big, and they had a good first quarter. So I don't think people realize that this $70 is like the new $100. Well costs have come down, drilling and completion costs have come down. They're getting better well results. They've figured out how to complete these. When they go into development, these multi-well pads where they're drilling a whole bunch of wells from the same location, that cuts down on the average well cost for all of them put together. And they're still paying out now, man. If you're at $65 oil, you're paying out in months, not years. So these well-level economics are outstanding at current price. And I look at a lot of companies now, and I can't believe they're trading for 3, 4, 5 times cash flow, which is insane.
So as you look at the news this Friday with Saudi Arabia and Russia supposedly going to add 1 million barrels of production, Dan, you think if they can, it's going to be gradual. It's going to take time. We're right in the middle of the strongest time of the year for demand for energy. So would you expect this correction that we're seeing to eventually turn around as we head into the summer months where we see strong demand?
Yeah, if 67 holds, then we're still in like the fourth stage of this rebound. And I see by the end of the summer, we're going to see inventories around the world way below the 5-year average. And when that happens, you've just got to start getting higher prices because you've got to start gearing up some of these big projects that have longer lead times. And the companies are not going to do that until they're very confident of a higher price range. So those chickens are going to come home to roost here pretty soon, and we're maybe headed into a multi-year period of kind of very, very tight oil market.
Well, listen, Dan, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the work that you do at Energy Perspectives, tell them how they could do so.
If you're interested in getting a membership for our services, and we're a subscription service, we, you know, look very closely at a bunch of public companies. I'm focused this week actually on some very attractive small cap companies. And we do a monthly newsletter, but you can just send me an email at energyprospectus@gmail.com, and we can tell you how to join. And as a listener to your show, they get $100 off the first year of subscription, which is usually $350 a year, so that would be $250 a year.
Well, listen, Dan, as always, it's a pleasure speaking with you. Have yourself a great weekend and enjoy your gasoline prices before they go up even more.
Enjoy it while it lasts.
Well, last year when the stock market was a one-way ride up, we warned where the next bubble in the bull market would be in passive index funds, which, if you notice, are the current investment fad. Today, coming up next on The Big Picture, we're going to alert you to that one big risk out there that very few people are discussing, and that is liquidity in the markets, along with the factors that are driving it. All of that coming up next on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertised with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.